We just finished an hour walking through Sarah Bowling, Marilyn Hickey's daughter, message from their Today with Marilyn and Sarah program. They have big healing ministry. At the end, we didn't get a chance to play for you because time ran out. She had a prayer for healing for everybody who has cancer and promised healing through their anointing oil and things like that. We've got a far more scripturally based teaching on healing for you as our Issues, Etc. book of the month for September. It's called Order Restored. It's a look at biblical healing, at healing medicine, from a rather scholarly perspective, I might say, but also scripturally sound. Order Restored is $20.99 plus shipping and handling. You can order it from Concordia Publishing House. Call them any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website and browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. You'll find the book Order Restored. It's our Issues, Etc. book of the month for September. Helen Hull Hitchcock joins us. You may have seen the headlines. I saw them, and then, of course, it was on the TV news and the radio as well. Burke clarifies voting stance. There's also, I guess you could call it an op-ed piece, Burke clarifies stance on voting. And I'm a bit confused. I hope that Helen can clear up the confusion, for good or for ill, as we talk about these recent press statements made by St. Louis Archbishop Raymond Burke on Roman Catholics and voting for pro-choice lawmakers. After we concluded our conversation with Helen, we have open lines for your questions and your comments, and I would like your reaction to the bishop's clarification that's been in the news as well. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Helen Hull Hitchcock is a regular guest. She's founding director of Women for Faith and Family, a support organization for Orthodox Catholic women. Helen, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Okay, I have to say at the outset that I really have no place to throw stones here because many pastors and leaders in my church body wouldn't touch this issue with a 10-foot pole. They would hardly even come close to making the first statement, I mean the second statement that Burke has made, much less the first statement that he made that he seems to be backing down on. To that end, am I missing something? Is the bishop backing down?
To put a fine point upon it, no, he isn't backing down. I think we got we clarify a little bit what was actually in that press statement. And the problem is, of course, the bishop is not responsible for the headline writer on that.
Sure.
But no, he isn't backing down. This is the position that's been there all along. And it's not, he didn't invent this either, his stand, because it's firmly grounded in recent church documents and in recent church teaching, and even in a memorandum that was issued by Cardinal Ratzinger, who is head of the congregation at the Vatican that deals with assuring doctrinal integrity. So it's I think we've got a problem with understanding what the issues are, and also perhaps the reporter didn't really understand what he was saying.
Okay, now the first statement by Bishop Raymond Burke that was made not only in advance of his coming to St. Louis but also very shortly after he came to St. Louis had to do with whether or not it was a sin for Roman Catholics to vote, knowingly vote, for pro-choice lawmakers, and whether or not that would constitute a grave sin. He seemed rather unequivocal at the time, saying, yes, it would constitute a grave sin.
Mm-hmm.
The clarification, what does it say? And please, if you would, I remain somewhat unconvinced, make the case for me that this is not a loophole that amounts to a retraction.
Well, here's the thing. And let me refer to Cardinal Ratzinger's memo, which I'm sure Archbishop Burke had in mind when he tried to clarify that for the reporter. The memo that he issued repeatedly said that abortion or euthanasia is a grave sin, and but in a footnote to that, he used technical, you might say moral theological jargon, which is, I think, the problem, that people don't understand what he used the phrase remote material cooperation, and he used the phrase presence of proportionate reasons. Now, those have technical meaning to moral theologians, but they have a slightly different meaning to the general public. And I think the Archbishop was trying to clarify that, and I think the reporter just didn't get it. We could go into that if you want to somewhat, because there are, you know, there are resources for this. But I think the point is that the main part of Cardinal Ratzinger's memorandum, well, let me just read you one paragraph from that. It says, regarding the grave sin of abortion or euthanasia, when a person's formal cooperation becomes manifest, understood in the case of a Catholic politician as his consistently campaigning and voting for permissive abortion and euthanasia laws, his pastor, meaning his bishop, should meet with him, instructing him about the church's teaching, informing him that he is not to present himself for Holy Communion until he brings to an end the objective situation of sin, and warning him that he will otherwise be denied the Eucharist. So that's pretty clear. Then in a footnote to that letter, he said, if he were a Catholic, would be guilty of formal cooperation in evil, and so unworthy to present himself for Holy Communion if he were to deliberately vote for a candidate, precisely because of the candidate's permissive stand on abortion and or euthanasia. And then he goes into the phrase that I think maybe has been confusing to people. He uses, if he's not voting for the candidate's stand in favor of abortion, but votes for that for other reasons, it's considered, it could be permitted for proportionate reasons. Now, what the main example of that would be, if you've got two candidates, let's say you've got two candidates for president, both of them have voted for pro-abortion legislation. One of them has voted for legislation that permits abortion only in a very narrow range of cases for rape and incest. Let's say. Now, the Catholic Church would say, you can't, that's not permissible. That's not what our church teaches, that you can abort anybody. But let's just say that you, one candidate votes for this very limited circumstances under which one can have an abortion. The other candidate, however, let's say, is very public in his promotion of permissive abortion on demand. Now, if you've got only those two candidates, are you sinning by voting for a pro-abortion candidate, by voting for the first guy who only permits it under certain very limited circumstances, or the second? In this case, I think, especially if you look at what other else the candidate is in favor of, it would be permissible for a Catholic to vote for someone whose political candidate votes for abortion legislation for very restricted circumstances.
Okay,
do you follow me? Does that make any sense?
Well, let me see if I am following you. You're really talking about the case where it would be a genuine lesser of two evils.
That's right.
Okay, but they're both considered to be now. See, I would call them both evils, but it would be the lesser of two evils. One might also stay home and not vote at all. But if you're going to vote,
that's true. Another thing, in our particular American situation, we've got a national, you know, I mean, the law is that abortion is permissible. That's an unjust law. And not just Catholics believe it's an unjust law. I'm sure there are many individual Lutherans who believe that, too, even if the church hasn't taken a particular stand on it.
Well, they'll take a stand on it. They'll take a stand on abortion, of course. What they won't take a stand on is saying that people who vote, they won't touch that one with a 10-foot pole, so...
Oh, yeah. Oh, you mean the
voting issue.
For someone who... Well, yeah, I know. And here, I mean, it is difficult. For example, I mean, a lot of people... Let's just look. This is not exactly comparable. But supposing that you know that a particular oil company employs slave labor in Africa or something, and you know about this, and so you decide, I'm not going to buy my gas at that station. Because even to buy my gas at that station, even though I don't have anything to do with the evils that they are doing, the sinful things that the company is doing, but nevertheless, even by my supporting their company, I'm somehow in a remote way cooperating in the evil that they're doing. Does that?
Yes. Now, this is a question I had. Should we read the bishop's clarification to say, and here's the scenario that probably jumped to my mind and many readers' minds first, when you have a choice between a pro-life candidate and a pro-choice candidate, you could somehow find mitigating factors in the pro-choice's candidate's other stances that could allow you to, in good conscience, vote for the pro-choice candidate over the candidate who would...
Yeah, now that would be a very serious misreading of what the bishop has said and what the church stands for. However, there was a prominent Catholic priest who writes in the press who issued a column early last week, I think it was, Father Andrew Greeley, in which he said, oh, sure, you know, now the highest doctrinal authority has said that you can vote for a Catholic pro-abortion Catholic politician, so long as you're not voting for him for that reason, but you're, you know, shutting your eye at that and voting for him because, you know, you like some other stand he takes. That's not what this means. Because if you knowingly vote for a candidate who is vigorously promoting abortion, that means that you are participating in that sinful act. This is, again, we get into somewhat tricky theological categories here, but I think that's why Archbishop Burke probably tried to, shall we say, clarify, although I'm afraid the way it was reported it muddified it, if you can let me make up a word there. And that's because he wanted to make it clear that he was not saying that that you couldn't vote for, let's say, a presidential candidate who is known to oppose abortion but has voted for pro-abortion legislation of the restricted kind that I said. And that this is, I think he wanted to nuance it somewhat. But the trouble is, when we live in a soundbite culture, nuances usually get muddied around.
Folks, I'd like to hear from you. What did you think when you read the St. Louis Post-Dispatch this weekend about Archbishop Raymond Burke and his clarification on a statement about Roman Catholics and the politicians they vote for? 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. I'd like to hear especially from our Roman Catholic listeners. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or any other comments you'd like to make about church bodies and pro-choice lawmakers. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here's a scenario, and I'm going to ask you if this fits the bill for what the clarification was intended to describe. And now I know I'm not going to put names on this because I wouldn't be sure about the names. There is a candidate for Senate who is pro-choice, but he's a Republican. He's running against a guy who is pro-choice, but he's a Democrat. Well, the Republican Party has a platform plank that includes opposition to abortion in almost all cases. Could the Roman Catholic then say, look, I know that the Republican is pro-choice, but I'm going to vote for him because it's another Republican in the Senate, and the overall pro-life goals of the entire legislative body then would be furthered by keeping a majority of the pro-life party, so to speak. Is that the kind of situation to which, or scenario to which, the bishop's clarification would speak?
Actually, I don't think that would apply there. And of course, if you get into very technical questions like the one that you just, and convoluted situations, as the old phrase is, hard situations make bad law. So it'd be, you'd have to weigh various factors. But I don't see how that could be permissible, because you're consciously voting for someone that you know to be pro-abortion. If you vote for someone who supports, let's say he voted against the Partial Birth Abortion Act, or he has spoken at conferences of Planned Parenthood or something, and promotes it, that's different. Then you're actively engaged in promoting his cause by voting for him, even if you think that the things that his party stands for otherwise are good, and it would be advantageous to have a member of that party elected. I think that this is the thing, and I think all Christians have to deal with these, even if their church hasn't spoken out on it. Our consciences are not formed by the, or at least we hope they're not formed by the government. They're formed by God, and we know in our hearts that it's an evil thing to destroy children in their womb or to commit euthanasia on a vulnerable person who's dependent completely on others for their care. This is not the way we're to express love for our brothers, our fellow man. I mean, this is written in God's law, not just in the Constitution of the United States or not just in the rules of the Roman Catholic Church. I think most Christians can understand that. What the Catholic Church has been doing this year, and it's gotten in all the newspapers all over the place, is because the situation is that one candidate, never mind what his religious affiliation is, if one candidate is vigorously supports abortion and another candidate does not, the choice seems fairly clear. These are the kinds of decisions that are very tough for Christians to make, especially when the stakes are very high, as they are in any United States presidential election, and other people are interested in it too, besides Americans. Almost every country is somehow affected by what happens in the United States. So that's not a real simple answer. But I think what the Archbishop is doing here in St. Louis is calling all of the Catholics that are in his archdiocese to form their conscience and to examine their conscience and to act consistently with God's law on these critical issues.
Helen Hull Hitchcock is our guest, founding director of Women for Faith and Family, a support organization for Orthodox Catholic women. Let's hear from you on this issue, especially our Catholic listeners. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We begin with Al calling from his car. Al, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I had noticed when we're talking about the news coverage for the politicians who are being denied Eucharist or it's been talked of because they're pro-abortion, in the Lutheran Church, if someone is living an open and unrepentant sin, we would deny them the Eucharist out of love to keep them from drinking to their condemnation. I don't hear that in the news reports. Is that not a part of the Catholic tradition, or is it just not being covered because it's not newsworthy to find out that the Catholic Church is trying to act out of love to the politicians to keep them from drinking to their condemnation?
That's a very good question.
Oh, that's a very good point, and that is actually in some of the bishop's statements and in the statements that the Holy See has made on this issue. That point is cited over and over again by the bishops who've spoken out on this. And that's a very important point of this, and I'm certainly glad you brought it up.
So, in other words, we're not talking about denying the Eucharist to the people who would be included in this statement as a punishment, but as essentially as a call to repentance so that they might repent of their sin and, again, receive the Eucharist properly.
That's true, yes. That is stressed, as I said, in the letter from Cardinal Ratzinger to the bishops that I quoted something from in the first part of this program, and also in the documents and the statements that have been made on this. Almost all the bishops who have made a statement have stressed that you might say medicinal aspect of it is to help the person who's in error to repent and get things straight.
Bible.
I should mention, too, that Archbishop Burke is making a statement on this, is writing a statement on this issue, which will clarify those moral theological issues that I just mentioned, And that statement is due out about the 1st of October.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from St. Louis. Kathy is on the line. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. I'm a Roman Catholic, and I was pleased when the bishop came out earlier and talked about the abortion issue and the candidates. And I just farm my conscience by knowing what Christ teaches. And I know it's wrong to kill children, have an abortion where a woman not only kills the baby but part of herself and the father. And I just was very disappointed then when he came out with this, statement last week or this week. And all I can say is ever since I go by the candidates, what they believe. If they vote for abortion, then I can't vote for them in my conscience. And all I want to say to all the Catholics who continue to support candidates that vote for abortion is that you can't be for Christ and against Christ at the same time.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Your reaction, Helen?
Well, she's perfectly right. And if she's got confusing, if you're getting confusing signals or you think you are, then you should go with what you know to be true. But as a matter of fact, I think it's important to stress that what the Archbishop did was not to back off, not an inch from what he said in the past.
Now, one thing before we let you go, because our time runs short here, and that is one other misunderstanding that might prevail among those who are reading the press accounts is that somehow the bishop has also backed off on the issue of the lawmaker himself, that the lawmaker could somehow weigh his other moral positions politically against a pro-choice stance and say, I can be pro-choice because, after all, I'm for this or against the death penalty or something like that.
That would be wrong, and that is made clear repeatedly and most recently in the Cardinal Ratzinger letter. Not all moral issues have the same moral weight as abortion and euthanasia. For example, if a Catholic were to be at odds with the Pope on capital punishment or war or something, he would not for that reason be unworthy to present himself to receive Holy Communion just because he disagrees with the Pope. But while the Church exhorts civil authorities to seek peace and not war and to be discreet about what they do about punishment of criminals, they might still be able to hold a war or have recourse to capital punishment. But there is not any, there's not any legitimate diversity of opinion about abortion and euthanasia.
Helen,
those are fundamental.
Helen, thank you very much for your clarification of the bishop's clarification, and thanks for being our guest on Issues, Etc. Helen Hull Hitchcock is founding director of Women for Faith and Family, a support organization for Orthodox Catholic women. The website for Women for Faith and Family, wf-f.org, wf-f.org. And we anxiously await Bishop Burke's explanation of his clarification so that we could have it from the bishop's mouth himself that this is not a retraction. After the break, I want to know what you think about this. Are you convinced? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Do you think this is something that the Church ought to address with its people and those among its people who serve as our lawmakers? Open lines for the remainder of the program when we come back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. Listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Dogs. Now, do they evolve? Answers with Ken Ham, one of the authors of the Answers book. Well, Ken, I remember my biology teacher once telling me that all the different species of dogs proved that dogs had evolved. But how do you explain all these changes in dogs?
Well, it's true there are many different species and varieties of dogs, but at the same time, we should hear what the secular scientists themselves are saying about these creatures. In a recent scientific article in the journal Science, secular scientists declared that all dogs shared the same gene pool. They stated that even the domestic dogs originated from wolves and thus are all related. You know what this means? All dogs are the same kind. Now, the Bible states that each kind of animal will only produce its own kind. But in school textbooks, students are still told that all the changes in dogs illustrate evolution. But dogs always remain dogs. The different species and varieties of dogs just represent different combinations of dog genes, if you like, from the whole gene pool of dogs. Now, this is not evolution in the molecules to man sense. You see, evolution requires new genes that never previously existed to arise, but one never observes this. As I say to people, dogs producing different species of dogs is not evolution, it's just dogs.
Has anyone truly observed aliens or UFOs coming from outer space? Well, that's the theme of Ken's free booklet, available on our website, answersradio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Children surfing the net can accidentally come across sites that are racist, violent, or pornographic. Some sites will even bribe your child with the promise of free prizes in exchange for personal information. Some sites may even try to arrange personal meetings with your child. Software filters can be helpful in blocking out unwanted sites, but there is no substitute for keeping your home computer in a central location so you can easily monitor where your children are going online. Remember, God loves our children so much that He sent Jesus to die for them, and He also guards and protects them from sin and every evil. And one way He does that is through the watchful eyes of Christian parents. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org. I mentioned at the beginning of this hour that our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is on healing. In connection with that, tomorrow on the program, Pastor Mark Sell of Concordia Publishing House is going to join us to talk about healing. And we're going to kind of take it from the perspective of the book, but also respond to some of the misconceptions about the role of healing in the Christian life that are so common in the church today. That's tomorrow on the program with Pastor Mark Sell. Also, the person and work of Jesus Christ, Ken Samples of the Augustine Fellowship Study Center, will join us, part of our ongoing series. Dr. Leonard Payton will also be our guest tomorrow on the program as well to talk about his journey from Calvinism to the true Reformation faith to, if I may say so, to Lutheranism. Dr. Leonard Payton tomorrow on the program. It's open lines for the next 25 minutes of the program. We just finished our conversation with Helen Hull Hitchcock. I'd like your reaction to the headlines that you certainly read, the stories you certainly saw or heard on the radio about Archbishop Raymond Burke's clarification of the voting stance. The headlines read, Catholics can at times vote for those who favor abortion rights. And what's the other headline? Yes, Burke clarifies stance on voting. Both of the press accounts, I read them as carefully as I possibly could, and came away with the impression that this was a backtrack on the part of the Archbishop. Now, Helen made the case in the last 25 minutes that this is not a backtrack. This is a genuine clarification. And what he is doing is he is including a circumstance, the kind of the lesser of two evil circumstance, in which a Roman Catholic voter could vote for a pro-choice candidate if it were the lesser of two evils. And she gave the scenario in which one of the pro-choice candidates was for, to the wall, for any kind of abortion, And the other one, and this is the only choice you're left with, the other one was may have been pro-choice, but in a far more restricted sense. Now, does this hold water for you? Does it still sound to you like a loophole that amounts to a retraction? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Your phone calls until 6 o'clock, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Anything else you want to talk about as well? Now, one of the things that I think added to the confusion, it's not so much, I don't think it was so much the press coverage, although the press does have a tendency. I don't think this is an issue of bias. This is an issue of trying to get the story out in a way, and written at the level of, what, a third grader in a newspaper, trying to get the story out in a way that is comprehensible and yet still engaging to the reader. And sometimes, yes, the facts and the nuances, most of all, the nuances get lost in the shuffle. The language being used by the Archbishop, however, where he starts talking about proportionate reason and formal cooperation in an intrinsically evil act, if you stop and you think about it, you might be able to figure out what he's talking about. But to use the ethical theology jargon in this case does not serve his purpose. It makes it sound like he's obfuscating. It makes it sound like he's equivocating. It makes it sound like he's, I know he isn't, but it makes it sound like he's resorting to jargon to kind of cloud men's minds when he doesn't really want to answer the question. Now, if you know anything about the average archbishop, these are erudite men. These are men who, for the most part, are either administrators or academics. And so they may be more comfortable in the realm of this kind of language. But the average Roman Catholic sitting in the pew needs to understand that the bishop hasn't backed down. Is that how you understand it? The average Roman Catholic in the pew needs to understand that this is not a loophole that says, go ahead and vote pro-choice. It makes no difference. I'm sorry I said what I said before. Is that how you heard it? And the average Roman Catholic in the pew needs to understand that this is also not carte blanche for Roman Catholic lawmakers to be pro-choice, as long as they can somehow make the case that their other positions morally balance out their violation of their conscience when it comes to their pro-choice position. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And the use of complicated ethical jargon doesn't communicate that as clearly as it probably should. Now, yesterday on the program, I'd like your thoughts on that, by the way, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Yesterday on the program, we were talking about abortion. I cannot remember the context of the conversation. We were talking about abortion, and I had made the case, I've actually made this several times on the air before, but yesterday apparently it caught people's attention, about the infant mortality rate in the United States. If you look at the Centers for Disease Control, for instance, how they list the infant mortality rate in the United States, they will give you a figure of about 0.0068%. That is, a very low infant mortality rate. That is about 68 infants die for every 1,000 that are born live. Now, obviously, that does not include abortion. I sat down one afternoon when pondering this on my day off and said to myself, how would the infant mortality rate in the United States look if the CDC, or anyone else for that matter, included the infants who die in abortion in those figures? What would the infant mortality rate look like? The CDC says right now it's 0.0068 of a percent, and that is 68 one-thousandths of a percent. That's very low. And that's because we have good nutrition and good water and good infrastructure. Sure. I wondered, what would it look like? And so it took me almost the entire day. I ran the numbers. Yesterday I said that after I ran the numbers, it came out to an infant mortality rate of 21%, which, by the way, outstrips any third world country on the planet for an infant mortality rate. And I have to say now that I misstated that number. It's actually 25%. Now, I'll give you the figures, and if anyone is interested, my email address here at the radio station, twilken@kfuo.org, T-W-I-L-K-E-N, @kfuo.org. Email me. I'd be happy to send this to you as an attached file. It's right here in front of me. With the citation for the figures, by the way. I'm not just pulling them out of my hat. The Alan Guttmacher Institute estimates, and they are actually a pro-choice group, a think tank, they estimate about 3,600 abortions a day in the United States. The actual number reported are like 800 a day. But the Guttmacher Institute, that is a research institute that is pro-choice, estimates about 3,600 abortions a day. Multiply that by 365, you get what the Guttmacher Institute reports in their own reports as the number of abortions in the year 2001. 1.31 million abortions in the single year 2001. 1.13 million abortions. Now, if you add that into the 27 some odd thousand children that die of natural causes that go into the infant mortality rate for the United States, you add that in and you do the math, you come out with an infant mortality rate in the United States of 25%. I want you to think about that. For every 100 children that are conceived, a quarter die. Now, let's compare that with a few third world countries. That is 6% higher than Angola. Anybody want to live in Angola? Not me. That is, they have an infant mortality rate of 19%, not counting abortion. That is 10% higher than Afghanistan. That is, they have a 14% infant mortality rate. That is more than double the infant mortality rates in Somalia and Rwanda. Two pleasant vacation spots. And it is almost three times the infant mortality rate of the Sudan. If you don't believe me, I'd be happy to send it to you. But that is the real infant mortality rate in the United States. If you count abortion, which I think we should, that's the real number. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Matt, who's calling from his car. Matt, welcome.
Hello, Pastor Wilkin. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
I am a relatively new Lutheran. I just converted a few years ago, and I probably should know the answer to this question, but I don't. And I suspect there are others who don't. And I was wondering if you could just talk for a bit about the basic LCMS or Lutheran position on abortion as a whole, especially within the context of, like, if a doctor told me my wife is going to die if she carries this baby to term, and abortion is the only way that my wife is going to live, my gut reaction to that is abort. Or if it's a 13-year-old who was raped by a father and it's going to scar her for life to carry that baby to term. Just what is a general LCMS position on abortion?
Are you asking for an official position or the consensus? Because they're two different things.
Okay. How about both?
All right. Matt, thank you very much. It's a good question. Now, I had looked at this about a year and a half ago because I had a caller raise a similar question. And at the time, the way I consulted it was by talking to the I didn't talk to anybody. I went to the website where there was kind of frequently asked questions, and you can go there as well. It's lcms.org and look under frequently asked questions, and somewhere in that long list of things you will find a position. The position of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is against abortion, and the question of exceptions is where the question mark remains. Part of it is how you define not to sound postmodern, but how you define an exception. Say in the case of a tubal pregnancy that would threaten the life of both mother and child. We've talked with guests on this program who said that's not an exception, because what you're talking about there is not an abortion per se, because the child is going to die. If that child remains in the tube and grows, it's going to kill the child. You're not talking about anything that it's even, the child's in the wrong place, just as if the child were outside the womb somehow. You know, I'm still working over that one myself, to be quite honest with you. I cannot tell you definitively, and I can be corrected, but I cannot tell you definitively that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod position recognizes no exceptions. I can tell you from my own perspective, it shouldn't recognize exceptions. Now, you mentioned the one of rape. There is no sense in trying to mitigate one crime, rape, by committing another one, murder. Yes, here's the basic fundamental question that every pro-lifer has to ask themselves. I've raised this before. Is the mother always better off having her baby? I'm not talking about a tubal pregnancy. I'm not talking about an ectopic pregnancy. I am talking about a woman who has a child in her womb, a fertilized child ready, headed to the womb or there. Is the mother always better off having her baby? This really clears up a lot of the questions about, like, rape or incest. It really does. If you say, well, no, she wouldn't be better off, then you're going to be one of those people who's willing to countenance exceptions like rape or incest, because it would mentally scar her. It would be difficult. No doubt it would be difficult. The question isn't whether it'd be difficult. The question is the mother always better off? I answer yes. And even if it weren't, the baby always is better off being allowed to come to full term. The baby is always better off. And that's the real question here. It's not the mother's welfare, but the child's welfare. We do not mitigate one crime, rape or incest, by committing another crime, the murder of the child. So if you want a clarification on the actual position, and I don't have access to the web right here, you would go to the website for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and see whether or not they countenance any exceptions. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jean's up next, calling from St. Louis. Hi, Jean.
Hi. Just a thought on this about rape and incest, too. To have an abortion will not make the girl unraped. She will still have been raped. She will still have to deal with that. I understand that, especially if it was with incest or even just not. There's still some psychological and emotional things to be dealing with, whether she keeps the baby or not, or gives birth to the baby or not. But just having abortion does not make it all go away. She still will have been raped. She still will have been a victim of incest, or even if it's just indiscriminate or unprotected sex.
And I will tell you one thing. I'm not a woman, but I will have, having talked with women who have undergone abortion that were whimsical abortions. I'm thinking about Olivia Gantz in particular of National Right to Life. Having talked with her on numerous occasions, she was further traumatized by the abortion. She was further traumatized. It assumes that abortion is somehow a non-traumatic experience, that it wouldn't further scar the woman. You are adding to the woman's trauma by not only she's been raped, why make it worse by also saying, oh, then she needs to also have an abortion?
That's right.
You won't make it better, you'll make it worse.
That's right. Just for the record, for what it's worth, I have an aunt who is the product of incest. There's no problem in the family about this. And she's just as much beloved by the family and by the Lord as anyone else.
Thank you very much, Jean. Thank you. Yeah, try talking to a kid that's been the product of rape and ask them whether or not they'd be better off if they would have just been snuffed out. The author of a new book, it's called The Empty Cradle, he says that fertility figures suggest that the future is going to belong to people of faith. Let's hear from the author of this book, Philip Longman. Here's what he has to say.
Unless you are responding to a higher power, most people decide to have dramatically fewer children than their parents did. And so we may wind up with a world in which there are fewer people, but those people who are there will be disproportionately the products of religiously minded parents.
Now, the point here is that if you look at birth rates, we talked about infant mortality. If you look at birth rates in the United States, you find that the birth rate in the general population is barely at replacement levels, barely at replacement levels in the United States. The only thing keeping at replacement levels are religious people of religious persuasion. They are having more children, people of a non-religious persuasion, are having less. Longman says that people of faith value children more than secularists do.
The Bible speaks, go forth and multiply. The Quran gives similar messages. So it's not surprising that these are the religions that came to dominate human society. It's also not surprising that rigid adherence to these faiths put a great emphasis on children and family, and it probably gives them an evolutionary advantage.
Now, it's interesting. He puts it in those terms, and he's approaching this entirely from a statistical standpoint. Just looking at why, how do you explain the fact that religious people have more children than non-religious people. Do you remember back in the 70s when they talked about the population bomb and the population explosion and the world is going to be overcrowded? Now, you know what? The same people are worried about whether or not we're going to have enough people because replacement levels are not being met in most of the world. In fact, Philip Longman, author of this book, Empty Cradle, says that the fertility rates are declining worldwide except among people of faith.
The one thing that does seem to be able to sustain fertility to at least replacement levels is a faith in God.
Now, I don't know if it's the faith per se, but it is people who value family, children, and don't have the hang-ups, perhaps, about having kids. You know what makes that, I don't want to lose that train of thought, but what makes that tinged with irony, and really just the saddest kind of irony, is that at least among Christian women have abortions at precisely the same rate as non-Christian women. They do. And we had a show on this, more than a year ago, where we had one of the researchers on, and what she had discovered was that when a young woman who is a Christian, had an abortion, and was later asked the main influence in her decision to have her abortion. What was the main influence? These young women, young Christian women who'd had abortion, said the main influence in the decision to have the abortion was their mother. And it's not moms looking askance at them. It was their mother saying, you need to have an abortion. These are Christian church-going families. And across denominational lines, you're thinking, oh, it's those nasty other people. No, across denominational lines. When this researcher probed a little further, what it was the shame factor. The mother didn't want to be embarrassed by a daughter pregnant out of wedlock. It looked bad at the church country club or the country club church. It looked bad at the social. It looked bad at the quilting bee. So, I mean, I'm putting the worst construction on it, but what do you say when the mother is embarrassed to have a daughter with a child born out of wedlock, and this Christian mother who should know better advises her daughter to have abortions. So this is not all roses and daisies here. Longman, the author of this book, Empty Cradle, also says that religious people do tend to value children more than their material possessions.
They put different priorities on consumption, make different trade-offs, settle for the smaller house, settle for the lesser car, and listen to a different voice.
That may be, I'll trust him on this. That may well be true. Although, I think Christians can be just as materialistic as anybody else. They might reprioritize. Part of the problem we got among Christians is they tend to think of their children as possessions. That's why Christian daycare centers are packed. You know, you put the car in the garage, you put the dog in the yard, you put the cat in the garage or wherever you put the cat, and you put the kids in the daycare center, just like all your other possessions. Storage. Now, short term, 8 hours, 12 hours a day, but it's short-term storage. I mean, Christian daycare centers are packed, so we got a problem with materialism. We view our children as material possessions. I'm just trying to balance out here, just for the sake of clarity, before we start thumping our chest and saying, yes, we Christians love our children, and yes, we Christians are having more children, and we're keeping the world's population afloat. By the way, his survey does have to do with people of all different faiths. Longman also says that there's a political dimension to all these fertility figures.
Republicans are having dramatically more children than Democrats, and specifically conservative, religiously minded Republicans are having the most kids of all.
Okay, and this is simply just a correlation, because as we've heard from recent statistics, Republicans tend to be more church-going. And that doesn't mean Christian church, but that just means church, synagogue, mosque going than Democrats. It's just the demographics of the thing. And so you would correlate church going with religious attitudes and religious thoughts and with greater fertility, and therefore you have Republicans reproducing at a faster rate, which may, I mean, if you're watching the demographics for which states are going to be blue and red 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, this would be significant. If I'm a pollster, I'm going to be looking into the future and seeing that Republicans are outproducing Democrats. Finally, Philip Longman, author of this new book, Empty Cradle, says population figures suggest that the future will belong to people of faith.
Utah, where 70% of the population are registered members of the Church of Latter-day Saints, fertility rates there are double that of Vermont, a state that sends a socialist to Congress and the first to embrace gay unions. I mean, people who are fundamentalistically minded tend to have more children than seculars.
All right, and that's fine and good. So the Mormons will be reproducing along with us Christians, and we'll have more religious people in the world. And that's fine. Don't think for a minute, though, and put no stock in your future, because somehow you're going to be among friends. Oh, there'll be more religious people in our future. Won't that be nice? Won't the world be a better place? You know, the world has never been that nice of a place, and in previous generations, practically everyone, at least in this country, was at least nominally Christian. I mean, if you go back 100 years, practically everyone was at least nominally Christian. It's still true even today. You're talking about 86% of the people in the United States call themselves Christian. They call themselves Christian. And look what a wonderful place we live in. An infant mortality rate of 25% if you count abortions. So it doesn't necessarily bode well for our future if the trends continue to go the way they are. Christians know their future. We have a future and a hope that it does not lie in our ability to reproduce or out-reproduce the nasty liberals or the nasty secularists. That is not going to be how Christians survive. That's not going to be how the Christian church thrives. The Christian church does not live on our human ability to reproduce. Although that doesn't hurt in adding to the kingdom of God. That has its place. The Christian survives, well, Jesus says, man does not live. Man individually, man collectively does not live on bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. It's no wonder that religious people, and I would say Christians in particular in our case, would heed the command given our first parents, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, and have dominion over it. It's really no surprise. It's interesting to see it borne out by the statistics. That doesn't happen very often. Tomorrow on the program, Leonard Payton will be joining us to talk about Calvinism. We'll be talking about healing with Pastor Mark Sell. And we'll be talking about the person and work of Jesus Christ with Ken Samples. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.